This is Meatless, a podcast about eating. I'm Alicia Kennedy, a food and drink writer. I'll be having conversations with chefs, writers, and more about how their personal and political beliefs determine whether or not they eat meat. The show will ask the question, how do identity, culture, economics, and history affect a diet? In this episode, I talk to chef and chocolatier Lagusta Yearwood, who owns Lagusta's Luscious, a chocolate shop in New Paltz, New York, and co-owns the cafe Commissary in the same town, as well as the sweets shop Confectionery in New York City's East Village. I first came across Lagusta's work through her blog, Resistance is Fertile, back in 2011. When I finally got to eat her chocolate, I was even more blown away by her capacity to merge the sweet and the savory, the herbaceous and the rich, and to do it all with her politics and veganism at the fore. My first piece as a food writer was a profile of her for the now-defunct website The Hairpin. The headline called her the punk chocolatier, and that remains true, even as her work has expanded and morphed and will soon include a major cookbook. While sitting on a couch in her New Paltz chocolate shop, we discussed the blind spots of veganism, her forthcoming book, and how to bring politics into a business. Chatting with me for this. And actually, I wanted to start with getting you to tell me a bit about your cookbook.
Bah, okay. Already, I just made a weird sound.
It's okay.
First thing. Okay, so the cookbook is, it's called Sweet and Savory, with like an X for the and, for edginess.
Yes.
And it's The Art of Vegan Confections from Lagusta's Luscious.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically not everything we make at our shop, but
right.
A lot of things, the
yeah.
more maybe home-friendly things to make. It's roughly like half caramel type stuff and half ganache confections, so a lot of truffles, a lot of different caramel recipes, like rosemary caramel, and some like candy bars that are like a combination of like ganache layer and caramel layer.
Right.
And I'm really psyched about it, and it is definitely killing me. So
yeah. How long have you been working on it?
I guess about a year, but
right.
like really intensely for like 10 months sort of.
Okay.
But yeah, it's due in June, so I just have that pressure of, you know, getting everything done.
Right.
And it's weird because like confectionery stuff is so precise.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, I have people at the shop testing everything, and then I have recipe testers that, like, out in the world.
Right.
And just making sure that everyone is on the same page
right.
with how to do all this stuff. It's so different from just like, you know, put some stuff in a pot and
right.
cook it and add some other stuff if it doesn't taste good. So it's weird that like you can't taste the recipes as you're making them really because
right.
it's like 250 degrees sugar. So yeah, it's a funny project, but I'm pretty psyched about it.
Right.
It's
and
coming along.
What was the process to like getting to the cookbook deal?
It was very hard and stressful. Yeah, I happened to know a woman who's an agent, so I talked to her and somehow convinced her to take me on, which
mm-hmm.
was great. She's really wonderful. And then, you know, our like brand, quote unquote, it is a brand. There's no reason to put in quotes. is so specific,
yeah.
and our customer base is so specific. And I really didn't want to like water it down or like dumb it down. And I really didn't want to do like quick and easy, you know, vegan treats, because
right.
like what's the point of that, you know? That's not us. We are not quick or easy. But there are some easy recipes in the book, I will say. But yeah, so it was really hard to find a publisher that really got that.
Yeah.
So I had a couple meetings with you know, I just kept hearing the same thing in meetings of that the editors loved it and everyone was super excited about it, but they didn't. It's such a niche market that it's really hard to find the right market for it. But then I found a really great editor at DeCapo Press, who's super psyched about it. And so we'll see how it goes.
Right.
But yeah, it definitely was a long process of just convincing myself to not change my vision for it
right.
and to not, you know, no one really suggested changing it. I think everyone really was really terrific. And even the editors that like didn't, they couldn't really sell it, you know, they were still psyched about it. And
right.
no one was like, this is terrible, don't do it. But yeah, so we'll see how it goes.
What was the motivation for you to do a cookbook in the first place? When you have so much going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, totally. just wanted to. Yeah. I feel like, you know, I grew up, my mom was a writer, and I went to school for English, and just kind of felt that that's, the end goal of my life has always been writing a book, you know? And I feel like that's a very specific kind of person where either that's everything you value in life or that's not,
right?
You know, and like for people who are looking to write a book, like that's who you are as a person,
right?
And I feel like that's who I am as a person, and so that was just kind of an inevitability because of that,
right?
And now that, even though it was harder than I thought it would be, I am really psyched to kind of like get better at it, hopefully do like a savory cookbook and different things.
Right.
And it was really, it was a great process. And I feel like I'm kind of, my grandfather was a writer too and published books about nature. And so I feel like I'm kind of like fulfilling that family destiny of writing maybe.
Right.
So yeah, so it's nice.
Cool.
It sounds very egotistical, but.
Oh no. I mean, I'm a writer, so.
Yeah, exactly.
I get it.
You get it.
And I actually, I did like kind of become obsessed with like your work through your blog and not your chocolate. So
thanks.
For me, you are a writer. And yeah, so that brings me to like a first real question.
Isn't it funny though? Like, can I just ask you, like, isn't it odd this world now of like, I feel like I've always kind of like, well, I've always written things
right.
and I have like the blog and everyone has Instagram or, you know, whatever. But I still feel like we have this thing in our culture of like, if you have a book contract that like legitimizes you as
a
writer.
Oh yeah.
And I think that's such crap because that's not what I believe in.
No.
But then still for myself, I used to never want to talk about writing or anything. I'd just be embarrassed and like didn't, it just seemed like not a thing to mention or something.
Right.
Almost that it was like too sacred or something. But then when you have a book contract, like I feel like it changed for me. I'm like, okay, and now I'm a writer, which I'm kind of ashamed of that trait in myself. You know, it's odd.
I mean, yeah. It's a struggle because it took me a really long time to be okay with being public with what I would write or think.
Yeah.
And so, but I like even just signing with an agent made me feel like a real writer.
Exactly.
And then,
And then you're like, oh, my agent.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, so
it's like someone's working for me to like make me a writer. You know, I don't know, but I haven't sold a book yet. So
I'm sure you're around the corner.
We'll see. Cool. And so, yeah, but when I was, like, a new vegan, I was kind of freaking out about how the food was bad and, like, that I was, for me, food had always been very, very important. So, like, to go from a whole world of eating to feeling like everyone was eating, like, bad things.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Totally.
Just boring food that wasn't good. Yeah. And then, like, when I was reading you, I kind of felt like, oh, there is a vegan perspective that sort of reclaims what food is and real food and good food. And
I feel that way about your writing
all day.
Totally.
and also from like not a like bougie classist kind of framework.
Yeah.
So I wanted to know how you developed your ethics and palette and how they complement or complicate each other.
You know, it really came out of like an activism kind of spirit where I really felt like, yeah, it's weird because for a long time I was that vegan who ate terrible food, but I think that I don't like meat analogs at all, and I never liked meat.
Right.
So I feel like that was kind of good for me because I never thought that, like, fake meat was good.
Right.
So I think that's maybe a, not a trap people get into, but I don't know. I was never, like, impressed by any weird processed soy, like, TVP things. But I really had a strong sense, like, when I went to culinary school and even, like, in college doing, like, vegan activism and even in high school doing vegan activism, that, like, the only way to advance, like, the vegan movement, which really sounds so cheesy, but that really is my only goal in life,
right.
Would be to make stuff that was as good as or better than what, you know, than non-vegan food.
Right.
So I've always tried to market our stuff to non-vegans, and I've always tried to hold myself to a standard of non-veganism. It sounds so stupid, you know, but and really try to like not get bogged down in not be so much in the vegan world. Like
right.
I follow like very few like vegan chefs on Instagram, you know,
right.
not because they're bad. I just feel like it's not as, you know, this morning I was like, should I follow 11 Madison Park on Instagram? You know, because I was like, wow, what interesting preparations and what, you know, it's obviously not
right.
food that I'm going to cook. But you know, then there was like, here's our veal, like blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I don't know. Like, can I just swipe past those things in order to learn new techniques? And,
right.
you know, it's always been a line for me. And I really feel strongly that like vegans have to get out of the vegan bubble because it can be such an echo chamber of just congratulations.
Right.
And I think that veganism has changed so much and it's advanced so much since I first became vegan. But it's still just like everyone's so happy for what, like a cannoli or something. Right. I don't know. You know? It's like, not that cannolis are bad, but it's just strange. So, yeah.
Are there lines that you have for yourself with, in terms of that, with following along with restaurants that do serve meat and that kind of thing? Like, I have friends who work at the Green Market or something, and one of them posted basically like a pig carcass that had just been like roasted on a spit. And like, I know so many Puerto Rican chefs and they're constantly putting pigs on spits. So, it can feel a little jarring. So how do you kind of deal with that?
Yeah, that is really hard because I pretty much only scroll through Instagram in the mornings and at night, which it's like the vulnerable time when you're like, I really don't want to see like a whole dead pig. I think if some restaurant I follow did post like something like that and I was like, no, goodbye. But I don't follow a ton of restaurants, really. Right. I follow a lot of chocolatiers who aren't vegan, but they're not posting, you know, whatever, cows on spits. That's how vegan I am. I definitely have seen things that I'm like, that was not pleasant.
Right.
I went through this phase where we developed this, it's called the Pig Out Bar, this like vegan bacon bar thing. We make it every summer. And, I got really obsessed with wanting to make like amazing vegan, like a vegan bacon chocolate bar. So I just really went deep on like, what is bacon? Because bacon is so like fetishized and everyone loves bacon. And so I did all the like coconut bacon, like, which I think coconut bacon is terrible, just gonna say. So I started like smoking mushrooms and yuba. We use it's like cold smoked yuba. And I just really want to like get this bacon texture. But because of that, I forced myself to read this webpage about how to make bacon. And it was just real. I was really just like holding my hand up to the computer, like out the pictures, but I really wanted to know, like, how do you get these flavors? Obviously, it's like dead animal flesh, but other than that, there's something done to make it, be this thing. And I feel like it's almost like this game of telephone where everything in the vegan world gets reduced down to like, oh, bacon is smoky. Okay, so add liquid smoke, you're done.
Yeah.
You know, and like anything becomes bacon if you just add something that's like a little smoky.
Right.
And that's not how the non-vegan world works.
Right.
You know, and that, like, no one would let that fly. And so I think like we have to hold ourselves to this higher standard because everyone makes fun of vegans already.
Right.
So let's like not encourage that. But
You've been vegan for a really long time. Do people make fun of vegans less now?
You know, it's weird to me because I live in a completely vegan world where I literally don't go anywhere except for my own three vegan businesses.
Yeah.
And everyone who works at them is not vegan.
Right.
But it's not like people who at work are talking about like hamburgers, you know?
Yeah.
But I do, my sense is that people really, really make fun of vegans less because I don't really get in any fights about veganism ever. I mean, I don't know. I'm so far out of the world, but I've seen with the business, I've seen it change a lot where in the beginning, people were very skeptical about veganism.
Right.
And when I started cooking professionally, it was kind of the height of Atkins diet, which was just all meat and everything was like spelt. It was like, there wasn't gluten-free hadn't really started. It was like meat-free. It was like these weird trends. And now I see that like our customers now are like, oh, it's vegan. Oh, huh, let me try it. Like, there's so much more, you know, it's weird having a vegan coffee shop because, you know, we ask people what milk they want. And this happened to me like an hour ago. And this guy was like, whole milk. And I was like, oh, we don't actually have dairy milk. And then I list off our six kinds of milk.
Yeah.
And he was a super just mainstream looking dude. And he was like, oh, all right, I'll try the homemade cashew. You know, and I feel like there's, I would say once a month at the most, maybe we have someone walk out because they really want dairy milk.
Right.
But I thought that would happen like once a day.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I feel like it's changed a ton. But I still do think that vegan is still kind of a synonym for like crappy in the chef world.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
So there's that.
Yeah.
Oh, now we're getting a nice loud delivery.
Oh, it's okay. I actually kind of, like, I've been working on a theory around the idea that, like, vegan food is best when it's casual. Like, maybe I've just had this really strange experience of some good fine dining vegan experiences, but mostly very boring food.
Yeah, totally.
But I don't know. Do you think that veganism and fine dining can be compatible?
Oh, I think they totally can be. I haven't seen it. I mean, I'm trying to think. Like, even, like, I did this series of dinners, like, 2 years ago, and I did a bunch of these super fancy dinners, and it was, like, 12 courses, like, you know. But it was just, like, I'm not hating on myself, because I think I'm a pretty good cook. But it was, for me, in New Paltz, there's nothing like that.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of, like, it's exciting for people to have a multi-course meal. It's exciting for people to have, obviously, like, for it to be vegan. But I know that the techniques, like, I'm not a fine dining chef, right. You know, and, like, it wouldn't have flown in New York City at a real fine dining restaurant, you mm-hmm. know? And for me, it was fun to be like, oh, I'll experiment with spheres and molecular gastronomy and all these things. But, like, I see for myself just the disconnect between the level I'm at and true fine dining. Because, right. I, you know, I think just to sharpen my skills, I try to go out to fancy restaurants pretty often. And, you know, so I kind of have a good sense of what's out there. And I don't think, like, there's nothing in the vegan world that is, you know, as great as, you know, Alinea or something. But I will say, just to throw some shade, why not?
Yeah, yeah.
I went to the next, you know, that restaurant, like, right. vegan dinner,
yeah.
and I thought it was pretty a little dumb. Like, right. they did this fancy, fancy meal, and you had to bid on the tickets, and it was, like, the most expensive meal of my life, and I went to Chicago for it. And I was like, wow, this is what fancy chefs think of is vegan.
Right.
And it was just the most, you know, they had tempeh, and I was like, oh, do you make your own tempeh? Because I just figured, like, yeah, they're going to make their own tempeh. And they're like, what?
Oh, wow.
You know, like, you couldn't make tempeh, you know? And I was like, hey, you can make tempeh. Like, I don't know.
That's really
interesting to see the flip
yeah.
side of it,
yeah.
you know? And then when you go to, like, I know I went to Per Se, and, you know, sometimes you go to a super fancy restaurant and they work, like, Alinea, actually, it was like that when I went there, and they worked so hard to make everything comparable. There was
right.
nothing of, like, oh, we'll just leave off half the dishes.
Right.
Everything was, like, amazing, and they made a vegan version of every single thing, which is weird because it's owned by the same person who owns
right.
Next. But anyway, but then, you know, I've been to a lot of other fancy restaurants where it's just, like, even if, especially if you're with a non-vegan, and
right.
you're like, oh, I just got the sorbet
yeah.
minus the, like, other things,
yeah.
you know, and I feel like people really think, like, oh, that's fine because they're vegan,
yeah.
but to go back to your original question, I don't think there's any reason that there can't be really amazing vegan fine dining.
Right.
But I just think it hasn't, but it makes sense because when you look at the proportion of chefs who do that really high-end stuff, like, of course, there's just a lower proportion of vegan chefs in general,
right.
you know?
Yeah.
Okay, but I do really think that who gives a shit about fine dining?
Oh, exactly.
Also,
no, I agree with that.
You know, like,
yeah, it's hard because it's like it is the standard by which you judge, I don't know, what's
yeah.
going on. It shouldn't be. It's just...
Yeah.
It's,
but it is kind of fun.
It is
but
fun.
But it's kind of like...
But it's
whatever.
Also worthless, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, every time someone asks me my favorite vegan restaurant in New York, I say... Well, Superiority Burger and Toad Style.
Yeah.
And those are like...
so like... they're like cousins, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely feel that way. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Superiority Burger is someone who worked in the fine dining context and actively rejects that.
Yes.
You
yeah.
know? And really is like... But also takes that theory of hospitality and is... It's such a hospitable place.
Right.
It's not... But I also think Toad Style is too, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's just like, you know, cool punk kids who are like, let's just be nice to people.
Right.
Which
yeah.
is really what fine dining hospitality is. You know,
right?
So it all comes full circle.
I hope so. So you have the sliding scale socialist soup at Commissary. I wanted to ask how like important is the accessibility of your product to you, and yeah, do you think that there's things veganism can do to prove better that it is for everyone?
Yeah, I think that everything veganism does, it's failing at proving that it's good for everyone. I think that's the number one stumbling block of veganism is how middle class and white it's perceived as.
Right.
Which is so funny because there are so many traditions around the world that are naturally vegan that for some reason have not been celebrated within the American vegan world.
Right.
And I don't know, I think it's interesting like to do these... Like, we did this market this week, this vegan, it was called Vegetarian Food Festival, but it was vegan. And there's a lot of, like, African-American, like businesses there that are vegan. And like, this is a thing, but it's
yeah.
not celebrated. Or, I mean, I think it is celebrated, but I don't know. It's, like, kind of, we need to kind of amplify those voices a lot more.
Right.
You know? And I do think there is a huge perception that veganism costs you know, in terms of class, there's race issues, and there's also class issues, right. And that there's a huge perception that veganism just costs more. And I think because people see these $13 cheeses and, you know, really expensive meat analogs, when, of course, like, rice and beans is, like, the original vegan food,
right.
You know, and every culture around the world has, like, a version of that that's naturally vegan, but it hasn't, those things haven't been as, like, celebrated, sort of.
Right.
But that said, I'm totally guilty of that because we sell $12 chocolate bars, you know, so it's kind of that balance of paying a fair price for ingredients
right.
and that, and then also, you know, paying your workers well and making affordable things. So we try to kind of combat it at our coffee shop with a sliding scale soup.
Right.
It's strange because New Paltz is a very middle class town. It's a college town, and it's funny, like, sometimes I don't get the feeling that people who really need a kind of cheaper, like, pay what you want kind of thing, those people aren't coming to our coffee shop.
Right.
But I actually just rang someone up at commissary, and she just, it was just a person who was just like, oh, can I pay $3? And was feeding her family. She got three soups, and I was just like, this is what it is. This
yeah,
is
yeah,
so
yeah.
great, you know? And it made me feel really good. So who knows? I don't know. But I also don't think that, like, one sliding scale option on a menu is, like, it's not really doing anything.
Right.
You know, but I think that's really a more of an issue of governmental subsidies
right.
and wages being too low. You know, there's a lot of issues there.
Right.
Yeah.
So you are very careful with your sourcing of ingredients, and that is why the chocolate bars cost what they do. Do you think that within veganism there is a consciousness about that?
I mean, I don't want to just be a kind of hater, but
right.
no, I mean, I feel like I know lots of vegans who are very aware of it, definitely,
right.
but I feel like overall, vegans want treats, and they just really want
right.
What they want, okay, I have this theory about veganism, which is a lot of people became vegan when they were, like, 15, and so your palate gets locked in time.
Right.
And so you really want this, like, supermarket birthday cake you had one year when you were, like, 10. And most people grow up and they're like, I don't really want a supermarket birthday cake. That's not my ultimate treat.
Right.
But vegans always have this really stupid issue of, like, deprivation, which annoys me because I feel like it ties into all these class and race issues, too, of, like, you're voluntarily not eating something.
Right.
You're not, like, calm down with, like, oh, I just want this, you know, these, like, cravings or things.
Right.
So I feel like because of that, and I feel like there's this world now of, you know, with Instagram of, like, showing off the, like, fancy vegan thing that you got.
Yeah.
And you know, taking your picture of your ice cream cone held up against the wall or whatever. And it's just so, like, gluttonous. And
yeah.
I mean, I say this as someone who literally makes chocolate for a living,
right.
but it really kind of sticks in my craw a little bit. That's probably a non-vegan metaphor.
Right.
But yeah, so I feel like if we could really, and I know lots of groups doing it, like Food Empowerment Project is a great group that's run by vegans it's really like a very political, you know, overtly vegan and, you know, group that's looking into food justice issues. And there's
right.
lots of people doing things. But I think that the average vegan, are they really thinking about these issues? I feel like not as much as we could be.
Right.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like veganism stops for a lot of people with being vegan.
Well, I think that's the thing. The funny thing is I think people think, like, oh, but I'm not eating animals, so I'm doing this great thing.
Yeah.
But the weird thing about being vegan is, like, unlike, I feel like so many other, like, social justice or other, like, activist movements, it's really not hard. Like, especially after you do it for a while.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'm kind of privileged in that I didn't really crave meat, you know, and I've been vegan for so long that I don't know what, like, non-vegan stuff tastes like. And I don't want to say that for other people it's not hard, you know,
yeah.
but I think that for some people it's not hard. And then if it gets to that point where you're like, this is actually very easy for me, then that's your obligation is to be like, what can I do to take it to the next level? You know, because
right.
it's not really activism after a while.
I mean,
yeah,
it's terrible. Eating.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So are the same reasons, the reasons you became vegan initially still the reasons you are vegan, or has that evolved?
Yeah, no, it hasn't evolved at all. It's just total, Meat is Murder, exact same, you know, Morrissey crap.
It's his birthday today, apparently.
Happy birthday, Morrissey. Yeah. If you ever want a treat, listen to the Morrissey audiobook.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone knows Morrissey's insufferable. The audiobook really, really gets in deep with that. And it's read by a guy named Morrissey who's not Morrissey.
Oh, my God.
Highly recommended that. Anyway, the only reason I'm vegan is because I think if you can not kill something, don't kill that thing.
Yeah.
And that has never changed in 20 years. Right. 25 years? 25 years. Yeah, let's do some math. And that's, you know, there's lots of reasons to be vegan, like environmentalism or, you know, even human rights in terms of how the workers in slaughterhouses are, you know, have such high rates of suicide, blah, blah, blah. But for me, I'm like, if something cannot die for me, I'm going to do that.
Right.
Yeah. Simple answer for once.
So you recently, in 2016, you opened Confectionery in the East Village.
Yes.
When I was up here a couple of weeks ago, I was kind of struck by how many businesses had the signs, including yours, for like New York Healthcare for All.
Yeah.
Which I don't see ever in Brooklyn where I live or in New York City. Like, I never see those things. So I was kind of wondering how it has been running a shop there versus here. Like, what are the clientele differences? Who are the people who come to each place?
Yeah, I'm really fascinated by it. I think the reason so many shops in this town have those signs is because of one person.
Okay.
Welcome to a small town life. And the reason we have that confectionery is just because I brought it down.
Okay.
But yay, Beth Dulay, doing good work. It's weird because I feel like on the one hand, we have our customers who just come to us where we are.
Right.
So I think confectionery is an interesting mix, and commissary too. It's an interesting mix of, here is just, we're on a side street, so it's like the chocolate shop is like, you have to really come to us, you
right,
know,
right,
but
right.
Commissary people definitely walk in because they just want coffee, and confectionery people walk in because they're just walking past, and they're like, what is this place? I think it's a mix of people who know us and people who are just curious about stuff, and I think in commissary, we get a lot of people who are like, oh, I heard they have good coffee, and like, probably don't even know that we're vegan, and that's great,
yeah.
You know, and that I know we have a customer here who's been coming for years and years and didn't know we were vegan for a long time, and I think that's so awesome. But I think confectionery is so fascinating because, you know, I'm like, I lived in New Jersey, but I never actually lived in New York proper,
right.
And at one point I was working there like 6 days a week, so I've put in my New York time, but I still also feel like that girl from Arizona who's like so starstruck by like New York City. And it really is so New York City-ish. Like, there's so many bonkers people. It's just like, it is just itself, you know?
Right.
And even though the East Village is so gentrified and so expensive and so annoying, there are those bits of East Village-ness, which is,
there.
You know,
yeah,
why we opened up there. And it's really fun to see that, you know? And a lot of our core customers down there are just true East Village weirdos, you know? And thank God, it makes me so happy. It's the best thing ever. It's different and not different.
Yeah, every time I'm in the East Village, I'm like, this is the city I thought I was moving to when I was a kid. Like, because I grew up so close to the city, and I was like, oh, it's so cool. Like, in the 90s when I was a kid, and I'd go to the city.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, it sucks now.
It's true, yeah.
And it really does, but whatever.
Yeah, it's kind of also like, well, here we are.
Here we are, yes. Can you talk more at all about the phrase resistance is fertile, which is the title of your blog, and it's on the counter at commissary?
Yes. I was so embarrassed by it because I didn't really know, okay, this is going to sound insane, but I did not know about Star Trek.
Okay.
So I wasn't aware. I mean, I knew about Star Trek,
right.
But I didn't really think about this connection. Anyway, so there's this book, Oliver Creation by Ruth Ozeki, and she's an amazing writer. I love her work. And this phrase, resistance is fertile, is used in the book by these like anarchist punk seed weirdos, and they travel in a van. And and I just love the idea of putting yourself in a space of resistance and taking yourself out of like the world of sadness and Trump president and all these things and kind of creating your own world around you where you can have space to think about what kind of world we want and how you want to treat people that I like, it really is a very fertile space, you right. know, and I think that's really beautiful. So we're like, oh, let's put this on the counter at commissary because that'll be a fun thing. And so many people are like, oh, wow, resistance is futile. This is so great. And it took me like 6 months. So I was like, where is this from? Like, I don't know how I was so out of, I knew that phrase, but yeah. I don't know. So a lot of people, we have to be like fertile. But it's really, you know, I think a lot of people too are like, wow, that's really cool. But now I feel embarrassed about it. Like, it's kind of like that thing that's like your special thing. And then you kind of like my whole business, like put it out in the world a lot. And then and you're like, oh, yours. It's kind of yeah. weird now, but it's all right. It's now it's our Wi-Fi password. So
of course
that's how life goes.
So I think this is pretty self-explanatory and anyone would know this by coming here or anything, but, can you kind of talk about how cooking is for you a political act?
Sure. Yeah, well, I guess I just feel like it is on a lot of levels. Obviously, through your kind of supply chain and how the little ways that you buy things make such a huge impact. You know, we had a dish on our menu at commissary because it was winter, mashed potatoes and gravy, and everyone loved it. And we had like these nice green beans, and it was good because it was like January. Right. It was a lovely, hearty meal. But then we recently took it off, even though it was our best seller, because we were like, all of this is coming just from like our food distributor. And, right. you know, who knows? I mean, I think it's probably mashed potatoes are probably fine, but you know, sometimes you're buying like grapes from Peru and you're like, I don't know what the, you know, probably honestly the standards are worse in the US and I feel like they're probably better everywhere else around the world. I don't know. But you know, you don't know how standards are being upheld in terms of, organic or fair trade or, you know, well, I feel like I lost my train of thought. Anyway, oh, no. you know, so just trying to kind of, it is such a tangible difference. We work with a local farm for commissary to get a lot of our produce, and we plan our menus around what they have instead of vice versa. And every year we kind of sit with them and we're like, you know, and they're like, what did we not grow as much of this year? What do you need more of? What do you want to work with? So, you know, I always felt like we didn't order enough from them, and I always feel right. nervous about that because it's like, these farmers are like, you know, they don't do a full farmer's market because they sell stuff to us. So I always feel a little bit like we got to really support them. And then this year they told me that they recently hired a full-time employee because they're doing well because we buy so much stuff from them.
Oh, that's amazing.
You know, and it's like, wow, these are my friends. And now they started out being part-time farmers and now they're full-time farmers and they're hiring other people and they're building hoop houses and getting grants for greenhouses, you know, and it's like, that's a real difference in my community. So there's that aspect of it. I feel like also just cooking is so powerful in that people don't really cook anymore. And it's so, like, sounds cheesy to say, but empowering just to have that ability. I know for me, like, it's so wonderful for me to be like, this is what I'm craving. I will make it for myself.
Right.
And it's just a really amazing, I don't know, feminist, I don't know, just kind of really great act of like, I can take care of myself and be nice to myself. And, you know, it's really self-care and all those things.
would you give advice to someone if they came to you and they were like, how can I better support my local food economy? What would you say?
Wow. Huh. Yeah. I feel like so, you know, that like Woody Allen quote of like, something people who show up, you know, it's just, I feel like just showing up and just, going to your farmer's market. You know, we have a weird catch-22 with a farmer's market in New Paltz that drives me crazy, where we don't have a good farmer's market. And it's because all the farmers don't want to come to a market that's not well attended.
Right.
But all the people don't want to come to a market where there's no produce.
Right.
So it's just been like this for years. And I think working in your community to see how to kind of bring food to your community and work with different farmers and see what they need. And, yeah, I don't know. I feel like there's a million ways. I know that Dot, who works at commissary, they just started like it's like Food Not Bombs type group, but it's not Food Not Bombs, which is funny because there is a Food Not Bombs in New Paltz, but they're starting their own thing, which is awesome. And it's just so cool. They're so excited. They're cooking their first meals for it today and just little things like that of like just cooking meals for your community or, yeah, I don't know. I think just kind of looking around and being like, what do people need? How can I engage with this system?
Right.
If that made sense.
Are there any books that have kind of created your politics and ethics that you, or like required reading, you would say?
So many.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's see. In terms of like, okay, in terms of like veganism,
right.
I really think that Carol Adams' books are amazing. Sexual Politics of Meat, like, just really turns your brain inside out. And like Pornography of Meat is amazing. I know she just put out a new book, Burger, which I have on hold at the bookstore.
Yeah.
I haven't picked it up, but it was good.
It was good.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Nice. Yeah, she's really great. It's really funny because when I became vegan, I was super into Diet for a New America, which is the most old school vegan book. I wonder what would happen if someone read it now. I don't know. It's interesting. It's interesting because it's written by John Robbins, who was the heir to the Baskin-Robbins fame. So that's really fascinating. Let's see. In terms of, I think there's a lot more food books. I really love, there's a series of business books from Zingerman's Deli, and it's called, like, The Lapsed Anarchist Guide to, they have one of, like, Being a Better Leader and, I don't know, a bunch of different ones. And there's like 6 different books. Those are really great for me in terms of business advice and just kind of being like, oh, so you, at first I laughed at the idea of like anarchist business book, but it's kind of like a weird little subgenre that has been really great of, I think it's very easy for like quote unquote real anarchists to really laugh at. And I get why people would, because obviously anarchism is incompatible with capitalism. However, here we are and I'm just going to try to do the best I can within this world I'm in.
Right.
And so within that, you know, there are a lot of good books about like, okay, you're trying to run a business with a heart. How can you do this in a way that's minimally harmful to your employees? And I think also a lot of small business owners who've been in like activist backgrounds, it's really hard, and women especially, it's really hard for people to kind of make their peace with how to be a leader in a way. And so that was really good for me to have a book that's like, let's face it, you're a boss.
Yeah.
Just learn how to be a good one, you know, because you're not helping anyone by deflecting, by admitting you don't have power, you know. And maybe that's a true anarchist would say that I've been totally brainwashed, but here we are today.
Right.
Yeah.
So what are you excited about in the next, like, 6 months, year? What's really exciting you?
Okay. Here's my thing.
Okay.
I'm super excited to finish this book.
Right.
And then for the first time ever, I'm going to try to learn how to relax. That's what I'm excited about. I'm going to try to take 2 days off a week, which sounds insane.
Right.
And just saying it, I feel like a little nervous. But yeah, I'm going to try to really like learn how to be a human being who's not focused on work all the time. I don't know if that's where your question was leading.
No,
but,
yeah.
I mean, work-wise, I'm always super excited about like, we're always, it sounds really cheesy to say, but we're always doing a little bit better than we were before. And it's so funny to look at where we were even 6 months ago and be like, oh, we hadn't figured out that you could cut the tahini meltaways this different way. You know, just these little changes that so many people on our staff will see things that in a way that I would never see it and point them out. And it just like changes our lives sort of.
Right.
So I'm always excited for that kind of stuff. Yeah, I don't know. Just all kinds of little things like that. I feel like I used to have all this nervousness about hiring people and kind of bringing new people into our fold and training them. And it's so much work. And now I kind of have an excitement about like meeting new people and giving them good skills and hopefully good jobs and stuff like that. So, yeah.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you for chatting with me.
Well, thank you.
You're
a personal hero of mine. Oh, okay. So this is a real treat.
Oh, thank you. That's crazy.